Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Oshman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 220, Viral Philanthropy. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And we are here today with our guest, Lila Corwin-Berman. She is a returning guest, as many of our guests during this period of COVID-19 are, because one thing is that we know that we want to do less editing here on Judaism Unbound, and so it's easier to invite people that we know don't need much editing. And our guest today is certainly one of those. Lila Corwin-Berman is a professor of history at Temple University, where she holds the Murray Friedman Chair in American Jewish History and directs the Feinstein Center for American Jewish History. She is the author of many books, including a forthcoming book that will be released from Princeton University Press this fall titled The American Jewish Philanthropic Complex, The History of a Multi-Billion Dollar Institution. And that's the subject that we wanted to talk about today, because as we face a new situation in the Jewish world in America this year, but maybe even more profoundly, a new situation in the history of American Judaism, it's quite clear that it's that, but maybe in the history of Judaism, it would be important to talk about one of the biggest factors in that world, which is how these things are funded, whether those things are funded by individual people, members, or other kinds of ways, or in the case of what Lila Corwin-Berman is studying, philanthropy. So Lila, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you back.
Thanks so much. It's nice to be here.
So I thought we could just get started by your helping us frame the questions that we should even be asking. I mean, I'm asking myself a lot of questions relating to philanthropy because, perhaps stupidly, but trying to help, we launched a whole new project a month ago in specifically responsive to this situation. And, you know, then a week later, you're like, wait a second, how are we going to fund this? So this is certainly of personal interest, but I think also of profound interest for the entire Jewish community. So could you help us by starting to frame, I guess, if you were talking to philanthropists and or if you were talking to regular Jews or institutional leaders who are saying, how should we be thinking about philanthropy? What do you think are the specific questions that ought to be driving the conversation these days?
Well, you know, I'm a historian, so those are the ways, a kind of historical approach is the way that I think about the present. And so obviously, we're all in this period of feeling crisis and feeling traumatized. And I think it's, you know, very legitimate to first ask, are we doing what we need to do to take care of ourselves and our communities? And there are things that people need to do immediately to make sure that families have food, that people have access to healthcare. There are just a lot of immediate needs. And, you know, I think that we're absolutely kind of all in it and need to just recognize that before we can start to ask some of the questions that, you know, frankly preoccupy me, we kind of need to take a beat and make sure that we're asking those kinds of very basic questions. But as we get more into this and we realize that this is not just this punctuated moment, that this is going to last for a while, whether we think of it as a hammer and a dance, a roller coaster, multiple curves, whatever it might be, that we're in it for a while, and whatever it might mean to come out of it, we're not going to be the same. And so I do think that I feel like there's an urgency for asking questions about how did the way that we were doing things in the past when it comes to the allocation of resources and the real value of these funders in determining allocation of resources and determining priorities, how did that become the normal? Right? How did we get to a point where, and I think specifically the two trends that seem most crucial to what that normal had become have to do with endowment building and you know, holding on to resources and building those resources through capital markets, and have to do with the power of very few individual givers or donors. So those two features that I would argue are the most important features of what had become the normal, I think the moment requires that we ask some questions about why did that become the normal And to what extent is that normal helping us now? And to what extent is it hindering us as we think about what might come next?
Right. I mean, a shift to a business model where it moves from this kind of thing that's supported by a large number of people giving a small amount to a model where, in one way or another, it's a small number of people giving a large amount. On the one hand, that allows the thing to become much grander and much, much more stable in some ways, right? Or at least in certain times. It's times of stability, it's stable. And I guess one of my questions is whether what we're experiencing now in the post-COVID era, to what extent do you see it as being particularly aggressive in terms of the pain because of maybe a shift in how philanthropy was supporting the various parts of the Jewish community in the years prior? And I'm thinking, for example, like that I'm struck by how it feels like maybe more synagogues are going to make it through this, because synagogues are kind of supported by this membership model where if your synagogue is relatively good and there are a lot of people that feel connected to it, then they're probably going to keep paying those dues for a year or two, even if they're not getting quite the same level of experience that they were getting before. Whereas if you're a model like a JCC, for example, which has been subsidizing its Jewish content piece largely through other types of things like a gym and things like that, people may not be as willing to support you through that period because they were seeing it as a fee for service. And that's fine when they're getting the service, but as soon as they're not getting the service, they're not really willing to support you for that because they were never really believers in the mission. And then the third model is one that's almost exclusively funded by philanthropy. And I guess my question on that is where do you see that already going and where do you see that potentially going? And I guess fundamentally the question is whether the way in which a lot of elements of Jewish life have become supported almost exclusively or most importantly by large amounts of philanthropic dollars, is that something that's already become dysfunctional now that we've reached this, or is that actually maybe a source of stability?
I mean, there's a lot there that you're asking about. And, you know, I think one piece that I want to pull out from what you just said, you know, is the question of whether the kinds of trends that we've seen in Jewish philanthropy and that I think we've seen in philanthropy more generally in the United States, to what extent are those trends now participating in the ability or inability of our society to respond to the crises that are happening now? Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that this question could cut a lot of different ways. Like somebody could make an argument, and it wouldn't be a bad argument, saying, look, the fact that organizations, you know, big institutions like foundations and federations have put so much effort into building up endowments, really, you know, that's a movement that started in the 60s, but didn't start to really grow until, let's say, the 80s and has just taken off in the last couple of decades. The fact that they have invested so much in endowments, holding back these resources, growing donor advised funds, allowing many, many more forms of restricted endowment building, means that now when we're in this crisis period, there are these resources that can be used. And that, you know, in fact, the very logic of endowment building in the research that I've done in this period of the 20th century itself came out of trauma and came out of a fear about the survival, just a very existential thing, the survival of the Jewish people. And it's no coincidence in my mind that as, you know, that kind of pivot that happened among Jewish federations and Jewish communal leaders and wealthy members of the community to endowment happened in that kind of, you know, traumatic post-Holocaust period, right? At this kind of question, like, what is it that we can do to ensure perpetual survival of the Jewish people? And making a gamble that one way to do it was to invest in the capital markets and to hold endowments as the kind of corpus of those investments. So you could absolutely see, for example, then that these endowments are what's going to, you know, really help Jewish organizations and Jewish families pull through this. And I think you could say the same in a sense about the individual givers, the fact that we moved from a system where there was more focus on many people giving a little bit to a system where there's much more focus on very few people giving a lot. And you could say, well, one reason that that it has happened in a sense is because economic resources and clunky big organizations have been judged over time to move less efficiently than those controlled by fewer people. And you know, that this has been part of the whole discourse of like a free market, right? And pulling things out from those massive organizations that are slow, that are not responsive, that are not nimble and quick. And so if you have these individuals who can, you know, in the blink of an eye, turn around and say, oh, you know, we had this money purpose this way and we're going to move it this way, then this too maybe, you know, is a gift for this moment. I would happen to want to debate very, very vociferously with the person who would be holding those perspectives, that endowment and, you know, kind of the mega donor phenomenon have put us in good shape at this moment. Because I would actually say that if we really carefully trace the historical development of these two trends of endowment and the mega giver, we actually would have to confront the fact that the same circumstances that nurtured them, that allowed them to be, and that in turn they nurtured, may be hindering really like a humane and just response to the pandemic today.
Can you say more about that, just to make it crystal clear? What is it about this philanthropic system that you wanna, that you would argue vociferously about has not made it something that is a good fit for the times that we're facing right now?
The basic question I think we have to ask is, what economic and political policies have made this sort of massive endowment building feasible and have concentrated so much wealth in the hands of so few people, right? So what are the larger kind of policies, the larger context of these two features of the philanthropic system? And they can't be understood without thinking about like a whole raft of policies having to do with tax reform, having to do with public sector investment in private business. So basically the public subsidizing all sorts of privatized efforts. And they can't be understood absent the way that lobbying and electioneering has changed. And it's all sort of lined by the discourse of the free market, right? So we have to ask, like, what were all those policies and forces that came into place that have made it so attractive for, whether we're talking about Jewish philanthropy or philanthropy in general, to put so much stake in endowment building and to really focus so much energy on those few individual mega donors? And it's a whole set of policies. And those policies, I think, are all marked by a general tendency to move against modes of public-based and public kind of grounded decision-making about economic redistribution. So those policies that I call these kind of, I bundle them together to and call them the sort of financialized policies, they have all tended to move historically against a model of a public being invested and involved in how economic redistribution works, and against models of public entitlement programs, against what we might understand as like the social welfare state. It's with the kind of evisceration and the emptying out of a strong public sector, of a strong social welfare state, that we get a much more logical and really rewarding kind of mode of investment in these private vehicles for holding on to capital and for allowing a very, very few individuals to have so much ability to control so much wealth.
One thing that I've read you write in a few occasions is you talk about endowments not only in general, but as in many ways a Jewish phenomenon, if I understand your argument. My sense of what you've written is that there are ways in which Jewish communal institutions and the endowments they build and the work they did actually were sort of a model by which the broader universe of institutions look, those other institutions look to the Jewish community in understanding how they would shift their models. And so I really would love to hear more about that, because for me, I mean, look, I'm pulling like my young millennial card or whatever, but like I have only really inhabited a world where these massive endowments are seen as sort of normal. Like it's not even me forgetting. It's not like I was around before in the 60s or before that. It's just, I've literally never seen that. So I think sometimes when I or when others hear that like massive endowments are somehow strange and new, it's confusing to us just because it's all that we've ever really seen. So I'd love to hear a little more just like, what was the drastic shift? Like, what was new about this? What was surprising in the mid 20th century when this happened? And to the extent that this is also relevant, how much of that was happening by Jews, by Jewish institutions in the Jewish universe?
Yeah, I mean, part of this is being able to see the familiar as strange, right? And I think that that's what sometimes historians are able to do that can be really illuminating. And, you know, it was also surprising to me to see the kind of vitriol that Jewish Federation leaders and Jewish leaders in general really spewed about what they called charity trust building, about endowment building, in the early 20th century. And, you know, as I reviewed the minutes and read different kinds of, you know, correspondence, whatever else that Jewish leaders were writing in the 1920s, especially, but 19-teens also, it was really significant how much they were saying that they want to make sure that they have a model that when they get funders, you know, individuals, families, whomever, to give them money, that money is like, acts like it's going through a revolving door, that it comes into the organization and there is an immediate and apparent need that it was raised for, and that they are accountable right to their donors saying, you gave us this money and we're going to pay it out. And it's going to happen every year. Now, the system was not necessarily like a bastion of transparency or power sharing, right? You know, the way that the Federation model, for example, worked is that there were lots of agencies that became part of it. And those agencies were really limited in terms of the kind of fundraising they could do themselves. And they had to, you know, kind of make a plea to Federation that they should get funded at a particular level. And there were all sorts of power plays and politics that went into that. But the basic like accounting method was that whatever was raised was the money that was meant to be circulated. And in the bylaws of most of these federations, they wrote into them limits on the amounts of reserves that they could hold, because they really felt like their donors would not look fondly on, you know, holding capital back. And they saw like, you know, the kind of like Gilded Age barons like Rockefeller, Carnegie, as really using money in nefarious ways, because they had all this money and they kind of earmarked it for the public good, and then they weren't spending it. And so it really took it was not only a legal shift, because that legal shift did happen. I think I make a big deal about that, but it took a kind of culture shift to say, oh, actually we should be raising money that we hold back. And it's not just, you know, small amounts as a kind of rainy day fund or emergency fund, but it should be massive amounts. And we should even so much as allow individuals to restrict what they give to us and say, I only want this going for X, Y, or Z, and maybe restrict it in perpetuity, right? If we can count that as part of this money that we're holding back. And I really think that part of that shift had to do with a sense of trauma from World War II. It also certainly had to do with a sense of more economic abundance that happened for American Jews in that period. So let me stop there for a minute, because I just said a lot. I know you had a part two to your question, like how much of this was unique to Jewish institutions. But let me make sure that I'm not missing something in that part.
No, that was beautiful. It's less how much is unique to Jewish institutions. I'm curious if there are ways, this is actually less important, so we don't have to go deeply down this, but I think you've written about how, to some extent, Jewish institutions were some of the first case studies from which other broader societal institutions sort of learned this. And so I'm curious about that. It doesn't need to be a big tangent, but if I'm, Yeah, I'm just curious to
hear. So you know what? I'll answer that just by something quite small about that, because that's a much bigger issue, I think, which is that there were particular historical reasons that intersected that made it such that Jewish institutions were ready, in a sense, to embrace this more financialized logic of philanthropy and investment-based logic of philanthropy after World War II. And that those historical circumstances in turn intersected with some really cataclysmic or transformative changes in American economic and political policy. And so it meant that the interests that Jewish leaders had in starting to kind of hold back capital and to grow capital in different ways was sort of marching in step with some shifts that were starting to happen in American tax policy and American financial policy that were, you know, sort of slowly pulling back on, in general, a kind of redistributive logic of economic growth and state growth. It's not just that this was something like totally unique to these Jewish institutions, but it was happening in this kind of conversation and negotiation and, like, frankly, like real conversations between certain Jewish leaders and the Secretary of Treasury and the IRS and whatever else of trying to figure out what this new system might look like, whereby the public good could be defined in more and more kind of private-based ways.
One thing that I want to explore a little bit is this question of whether the philanthropy-driven Jewish system is the worst of all systems, except for all the others, you know, the way that Winston Churchill talked about democracy, in the sense that I can definitely say what the negatives are. So, for example, one of the things that makes me concerned about the idea of the concentration of, let's say, Jewish philanthropic wealth, whether that is a concentration by large foundations or just a concentration in the sense that wealth in America is being concentrated and there's just a lot of wealthy Jews and there's a lot of Jews who are not so wealthy. And the ones who are wealthier are the ones that have the most influence, if we're talking about that being kind of the coin of the realm, literally. And on the one hand, the problem that I'm most concerned about these days is what if, and we don't have to agree to this, but like, what if Judaism is going to change profoundly on the other end of this, because there are all kinds of trends that were already in decline, and this has accelerated a lot of them. And there are also all kinds of opportunities. We talk a lot about digital. I don't think digital is the most important thing. I think digital is a tool that facilitates, for example, the most important thing being that maybe I have something in common in terms of what I'm trying to get out of my Judaism with somebody who lives across the country in California, much more so than I have with anybody in my neighborhood here in Chicago. And digital may allow me to find those people, but the point isn't the digital. The point is finding those people. And maybe that leads to a reorientation of Jewish life where we have quarterly huge gatherings. You know, that's a problem these days. But I mean, like in the future, we would have quarterly gatherings where we would travel to be with the people who we want to be with. And during the rest of the year, we use digital as a way of connecting. Let's imagine a Jewish life like that. When the wealth is concentrated in the hands of people who have been supporting the institutions as they were before, then the ones who may be more in favor of what I'm talking about, they have not been giving to Jewish causes in the past because it wasn't doing it for them, the same way that those of us who want that kind of Judaism haven't been participating in it. So the problem is that it takes a long time to convince those people, hey, it's a new world. Maybe I know why you didn't fund those other Jewish programs, but maybe you want to fund these new things because now they're more aligned with you. I think we can get there eventually, but that's a long time. Whereas the people who are currently funding Jewish institutions are probably not thinking that way. So then it feels to me like you're in this kind of weird situation where the money is continuing to follow these institutions that were already on the way out, and there's no money for the new projects that are rising up just to meet the current need, you know? And how do we think about that in a way that says, like, the philanthropists aren't doing anything wrong? They're not bad, but it's just the natural way that these things would happen. And so what do you do when you're suddenly in a situation that is profoundly different? And what can we learn from history? I mean, maybe this is something that we may have experienced maybe, again, after the Holocaust or the founding of Israel or the Soviet Jewry, where all of a sudden there's some new project And it's not really what we were prepared for, but somehow we are able to get behind it. I mean, is there anything we can learn from that?
One of the real difficulties with the philanthropic system in the Jewish world as it exists now is it narrows the range of possible ideas. And again, this is not done out of some kind of malevolent, you know, intent, but it's, you know, it's a relatively small landscape. It has certain defining features that, you know, make its boundaries relatively distinct, right? And, you know, there are people who are part of it and there are people who are not part of it. And many of them have self-selected out of it. It's not that the system is necessarily excluding people, although in some cases the system is explicitly excluding people. So when we're talking about a time of really profound crisis, when what you're suggesting, Dan, is we might be really ripe to think about things in an entirely different way, and yet we still have the kind of boundary lines of a system that was, you know, thinking about things as it does with the people who do that thinking, the way that change will happen is a little bit hard to imagine as happening within the confines of that system. We just learned this week about a really exciting and ambitious initiative called the Jewish Community Response and Impact Fund that's been, you know, very, very quickly and collaboratively capitalized with $80 million. And it has, you know, names that anybody who's sort of been an insider to the Jewish world will recognize, you know, of private family foundations and federations and the individuals who are involved. And those people deserve to be praised for having a really rapid response and trying to be really, really forward thinking. And those are the people who have really been in the driver's seat of the philanthropic system as it exists, and in the driver's seat of, you know, frankly, choosing which organizations succeed and get funding and which organizations either don't succeed and don't get funding or get told, you know, you got to find it elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And if you read closely the most elaborate document I was able to find that talks about what those folks are doing, their aim is still to maintain on some level a system that has the boundaries in place. Many of the funds, the loans are by invitation only, which is understandable from an administrative point of view, absolutely, but they're, you know, invitation only. Some of the grants and the loans have qualifications like that the organizations have to be deemed to be of importance in advancing the American Jewish community and or promoting positive engagement with Israel. You know, if my students wrote that sentence, I would say deemed by whom? And this is not to poke at this system in a way that is just, you know, like the peanut gallery, just throw, you know, lobbing easy insults. This is like, actually, these are the core of the issue. If we're actually at a point of inflection where it really might be that we need to ask some difficult questions about whether this system has fostered Jewish communities or has been part of a civic fabric of American life that is doing the best and acting in the most humane and just way for the most people, I don't think we're going to find those solutions within the confines of the boundaries of that system. And so is this a moment then to really think in a kind of radical way about a different form of power sharing? So one idea that I have been thinking about with some colleagues of mine in this larger rubric of democratizing philanthropy, right? There's a model that the Ford Foundation has written about that some folks outside, primarily outside of Jewish philanthropy, have been interested in called participatory grant making. And there's all sorts of levels of it. So you could call participatory grant making doing a survey of, you know, of a certain population center to find out what they think the priorities are. And then, you know, a funder doing what he or she may want with that information. Participatory grant making could be consulting. You bring together a focus group and you ask some questions and then you do what they want. Or you do with that what you want. Participatory grant making also could be actually letting onto the board of trustees of a foundation members of the community who that foundation is hoping to help with their allocations. You know, not just interviewing them, not just trying to get a beat on what their priorities might be, but actually having them become part of an allocation process. Or most radically, it can say, this is a community that we want our money to help, and we're going to put the community members in charge of what happens with that money. Now, lots of questions we should ask about that. And I think one of the biggest questions is, well, what's the role of expertise in all of this, right? Just because I'm in the thick of a community that's having a particular problem doesn't mean that I'm the one who best knows how to solve it. And so people who've been giving a lot of thought to this have all sorts of, like, in my mind, really productive and interesting ways of talking about how you can have a much larger set of voices who come to the table, who think about what happens to philanthropic capital, which is, you know, capital that anyway is massively publicly subsidized. And so these folks are already stakeholders in this. Mm-hmm. Without flattening expertise and without totally doing away with any kind of efficiency, I don't purport to know how this would work. But the one thing that I can say about it is that it demands a much more capacious understanding of who gets to be making decisions. And at this point, I think we are in a mode where we're anything but capacious in that. And I think the responses that we've seen, even these really praiseworthy responses, are not about opening that up in any way.
And I just want to clarify one thing before Lex asks the question, but I just to reinforce something that you said, for those who haven't been like deep in the philanthropic thinking, the idea that you think about philanthropy as wealthy people who are giving of their money to these causes they support, and that's true, but it's also true that they're getting substantial tax breaks on that. And so you have to think about it at least that a large proportion of that money that they're giving away would otherwise be paid in taxes. And so it really is public funds that they're able to allocate based on their decisions. And so there is perhaps a deeper level of responsibility, public accountability, for sure, to the American taxpayer. But we can even say, well, Jews are among the taxpayers. And so, you know, Jewish philanthropists should feel that way towards the Jewish community, and that it's not that it's wonderful to the extent that they talk about it being a sacred trust, and some foundations do, you know, but even within that, that there may be more of a case to be made that it is money that belongs to the public as well as to the philanthropist.
And just to tag on one short thing to that, in the space of Jewish philanthropy, it's also the fact that many of these Jewish foundations talk about being part of a Jewish community and acting on behalf of the Jewish community. And so, you know, a colleague of mine put this very well, that, you know, look, if you want to say you're part of this civilizational project, but then you act like really the money at the end of the day is yours to do what you want with, then you can't have it both ways, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not just a matter of tax policy, although I think it is to a great extent sort of formalized there. It's also a matter of like the substance of how these organizations fundamentally talk about what they're doing and what they're contributing to.
Dan, what your lens gives us the opportunity to do and say, which I'm always ready to say, is that if it's about, you know, Jews are taxpayers too, and so the Jewish philanthropists are accountable to the Jews, like the Jewish community they are accountable is not sort of the capital J, capital C Jewish community that we think of uh-huh. as like people uh-huh. involved in Jewish institutions. It's anybody who is paying taxes.
That's a great point.
And is Jewish. Like it allows it. And we've been saying that since literally episode one, that when we say Jewish community, we are laser focused on like the population of Jews, and also, by the way, loved ones and people that are part of the Jewish community, but may not themselves be Jews. As opposed to like, the set of people who go to our communities, synagogues and federations, et cetera. So that's not a question. That's just I think it's important to say that, because I don't know. I think that actually some funders are very aware of that and do process their work through that broader lens of trying to reach the entire civilization. I love that term. Others maybe less. So wanted to name that. But, you started by saying, I'm a historian. I think those were the first things that you said. And I was about to say capitalize. Wow. I don't want to capitalize. I want to benefit from that because you bring that lens. You speak beautifully and have in this episode about how what historians bring to the table is the ability to see the familiar as strange. So to see something that seems obvious about our world and actually know that it's strange because initially it wasn't always that way. And I also think the inverse is true. It allows us to see, and I'm sure somebody else has said this and been quoted, but like to see the strange as familiar, things that feel unprecedented, that least favorite word of most historians I talk to, unprecedented, because usually there's some kind of related precedent. We can see things that feel totally new as, you know, being present somewhere in the past. And so I kind of wanted to ask you, what are we doing? What are we doing well on that front? In what ways are, in the urgency of now, are we actually turning to the past and to history and finding lessons? But also, to be frank for a second, what ways aren't we? In what ways are we being way too focused on, you know, today or this week or the last month that we've been social distancing, such that we're forgetting really important realities of our world that have been urgent for a while, and maybe we're sort of putting aside?
So, I mean, one thing that I have been thinking about that I feel like we're doing well, and that has not always been the case when I think of other historical episodes, you know, where there's been real points of crisis in Jewish life or in American life, is I feel like there are a lot of people who are articulating the value of community. And I think that part of that is because the very vocabulary we're using is this vocabulary of social distancing. And I also think because we're in an age where we have ways of virtually feeling like we're in community with people who are very far from us. But, you know, I've just been struck when I think of other historical episodes of crisis, of you know, massive illnesses, pandemics, economic crashes. In the historical record, I don't see those kinds of like profound in the moment reflections on just how much people need to feel like they're still in community, because crisis and trauma can be so isolating, and that this actually is a crisis or a trauma that should foster a sense of community, because we're all in this on some level together. And, you know, I think that that is something that has been, it's not coming from the top of our, you know, presidential administration. I think quite the opposite is coming. And it's maybe in contrast to that, that I see leaders of these kinds of, you know, civic organizations stepping up, and governors also in some cases, like stepping up and just continuing to kind of make that case for community. When I think about something that seems like maybe in the Jewish world is a response, and I can absolutely understand it, I think it's an anxious response, and I feel it in the fact that I've reorganized my basement and cleaned out every closet and cabinet and whatever, but there's a frenzy. And I don't want to pick on you guys, but I think you're part of that frenzy of just like creating so many resources. Like we saw it for Passover, like, you know, we could have had like 80 years of Passover Seders, right? Like with the number of resources. And, you know, there's just a very, and you know, again, I think it's a natural and understandable response, but just to like pump out as much stuff and material. And I think of the labor that people are expending on that, and how much we all want to feel productive. So we're doing it. And I do worry in some ways just about the kind of energy that's being expended in being kind of productive. And is that a way of not looking at bigger, harder questions, you know, like I'm just going to focus on like getting, you know, another Zoom thing together and another guide for reading this and another whatever, and kind of get lost in that process. I don't think, you know, I'm just trying to think historically about other times when there's been crisis. And I think that it's always, you know, kind of building from a point of feeling like there's nothing there and you want to build something up has always been a kind of response. But we seem to really be in the thick of that desire to respond to this with, you know, a kind of frenzy of productivity.
That's a great note to end on. Know that we don't resent that critique at all. Like we're wrestling with it ourselves and figuring out when the too much level is reached, when it isn't. All of those kinds of questions are really important right now. And just in general, all of the pieces that you brought up for us to think about our Jewish philanthropic world, about our world more broadly, we so appreciate being in conversation with you. So thank you for joining us. This has been a really great conversation.
Thank you for having me.
And just to note that you'll be back in the fall when your book comes out. And we're really excited about that because we've been planning a deep dive into the world of philanthropy and how that has impacted in the past and how that's impacting in the present and the future now in a more profound way even. And we were planning to launch that with the launch of your book. So we're excited to, that you'll be back again in a few months and hopefully in a world in which we understand a little bit more what we're dealing with.
Yeah, thanks so much. I look forward to it.
So we're going to close out the episode. We appreciate everybody who tuned in live via Jewish Live today, watched via video. For those of you listening on the podcast, you could, that option is open to you in the future. So stay tuned for when we have new Judaism Unbound Live episodes. There's a variety of ways for you to be in touch with us, and we really deeply appreciate that. First, there's our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound or Jewish Live, all one word. There's our Twitter handle at Judaism Unbound. There's our two websites, judaismunbound.com and jewishlive.org. And last but not least, there are our email inboxes, dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last request we like to make, especially in an episode about philanthropy, is that you can support us financially. You can do so at judaismunbound.com/donate or jewishlive.org/donate. And if you're not able to support us financially, that's a-okay. And there are so many other ways, right down to just sending a supportive email that says that you appreciate what's going on, that really do matter to us. But the financial ones are good too. So thank you so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound Live.